Dear Bank Treasury subscribers, in truth, there are many gravity hills in the United States, and indeed in the world. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has four of them. The most popular one, the one that has all the signs that lead you directly to it, is a detour south off the interstate around where 76 and 70 are joined up in Bedford County, just south of Altoona and the State College. In short, from a big city slicker's perspective, with no offense meant to the local inhabitants, Gravity Hill is smack dab in the middle of nowhere. To get there, take SR 30 to the intersection with SR 96 and drive south to New Paris, a town with 192 residents and one traffic light. Pass by the old charming Old Log Church and drive on the antique-covered bridge. This is a sleepy part of the world, of hay seeds and haystacks, far from the madding crowd, if not the hustle and bustle of the big city. Not quite the Twilight Zone, but this is where you would expect there to be mysteries and cows that jump over the moon, a place where time seems to stop or to even run backwards. Of course, a little imagination goes a long way out here. On SR 96 south, make a right on Bethel Howell Road, otherwise known as SR 4016, and drive about 2 miles. Past the stop sign, now slow down, keep rolling, slowly, a little more, until you see the letters G and H spray-painted across the road. Drive for a couple hundred feet more down the hill until you see GH spray-painted again on the side of the road. Stop the car, put it in neutral, and check your rear-view mirror to make sure no one is behind you. Finally, release the brake and prepare to be amazed as you and your car roll back up the hill you just came down. Most people repeat the whole procedure a couple of times more just to make sure that looks are not deceiving, which of course they are, because you are really rolling down the hill. It just looks like you're rolling up it because of an optical illusion related to the terrain. So no, sorry, magic is not real. You cannot defy gravity, and you cannot roll up Gravity Hill with your car in neutral. Gravity is still gravity, and time still marches forward, even around Bethel Hollow Road. It is just a mirage, something that appears to be what it is not. The bank treasury world is filled with them. Neutral, for example, is an illusion. Bank treasurers talk all the time about how their balance sheets are neutral, positioned to be insulated from changes in interest rates either way, up or down, or so they seem to imply when they insist that whether the FOMC cuts once, twice, three times, or no times this year, they will still make their NII and NIM projections. This is exactly what the CFO of a global bank promised analysts on his bank's earnings call this month. Quote, "At this point, we're neutral. So if rates were to go up, rates were to go down, no material impact as it relates to our revenue," end quote. So said the CFO of a large regional bank in the Northeast, quote, "We are neutral to interest rates right now, so whether we get two cuts, three cuts, or we get no cuts, we're going to be comfortable with the range," end quote. So say they all. Which might be a reassuring idea in the boardroom, and it may seem that way to the public, that NII and NIM are going to fly serenely through the volatile interest rate storms. But in fact, bank balance sheets are regularly being knocked back and forth and tossed to and fro by waves of market uncertainty and surprise that affect NII and NIM. Even without pricing volatility, balance sheet mix is in continuous flux, as loans and deposits shift to the rhythm and timing of cash flows in and out of fixed and floating rate loans, deposits, bonds, and other borrowings that feed and drive NII and NIM. So nothing stands still, especially a bank's interest rate sensitivity. The ride is going to be a little bumpy, just as the Fed has been warning the trend with inflation will be, but it just will not seem that way to look at the reported quarterly numbers. You will not see the day-to-day, hour-to-hour, and even minute-to-minute volatility as cash flows in and out, off and on, deposit accounts are originated or closed, loan disbursements are made or recovered, and interest rate contracts are reset up or down. But if you have a minute, go into the back room and peek behind the curtain, because that is where you will find the real wizards, bank treasurers huffing and puffing and spinning away furiously in place on their flywheels, sweating buckets to keep NII and NIM on track and in time for the next quarter's results. Now, there are natural, fundamentally structured, asset-sensitive and liability-sensitive banks. They have very different balance sheets. There are banks that fund a lot of floating rate commercial loans and other short-term assets with a lot of non-interest-bearing deposits that can be withdrawn on demand. These are asset-sensitive banks, and they make more money when interest rates go up than when they go down. Then there are banks that fund a lot of long-term mortgage loans with time deposits that are liability-sensitive. They make more money when rates go down than when they go up. Savings and loans are a lot like this. For obvious interest rate risk and liquidity management reasons, there are no banks with long-term assets funded with short-term liabilities. And for reasons related to shareholder interests, there are also no banks with short-term assets funded with long-term liabilities. That said, given the inverted yield curve right now, that would not be a bad way to generate NII, at least not in the short run until the curve flattens out. But mind that there are no naturally neutral sensitive banks, banks with a bank balance sheet that makes the same money whether rates go up or down, at least not without some fancy ALM footwork to smooth over the gaps between their asset and liability cash flows. And even then, ALM can only adjust for volatility so much. At some point, the ride is going to be bumpy and a seatbelt advisable. And even if ALM could neutralize 100% of interest rate risk, IRR, make the ride so smooth you could swear you were standing still, no bank treasurer with long-term career aspirations would ever do so. Because the truth is that bank treasurers get paid to take IRR, not to sit in their foxholes resting on their overnight reserve deposits at the Fed earning 5.4%. So when they say they are neutral, understand that they do not mean IRR free, because nothing is ever IRR free, because you can always lock in a spread. Well, that will not generate NII growth or higher operating leverage. Besides, banks are in the risk intermediation business. So what is the point of setting autopilot for zero risk? Bank treasurers, like all traders in the market, are always assuming risk. They are the bid to every offer and the offer to every bid. They're to fund loans and take deposits, to make long-term loans when rates are low, and to take on long-term deposits when rates are high. Like traders, they are paid to assume IRR, but they are also paid to set limits and abide by them. Within limits, therefore, they short options on both sides of their balance sheet, to borrowers to prepay their loans whenever they want, and to depositors to withdraw their funds or shift up from non-interest to interest-bearing on demand. Deciding when to sit in cash, buy bonds, hedge or not hedge, all involve some degree of risk-taking and risk-setting. To quote Alan Greenspan, taking risk is the American way, true for banks as it is for any other business in this country. Quote, it is this freedom to take on risk that characterizes our economy and by extension our banking system. Legislation and regulation of banks in turn generally should not aim to curtail the predilection of businesses and their banks to take on risk, so long as the general safety and soundness of our banking system is maintained, end quote. His was not an outlying opinion, but reflected the mainstream prevailing attitude by regulators towards IRR and banking. An advisory from the Fed on IRR in the banking book, dated January 6, 2010, practically echoes what the Meister had said 13 years before. Quote, the regulators recognize that some degree of IRR is inherent in the business of banking, end quote. But there are limits to everything. Bank treasurers are paid to set policy, to decide how much IRR to take and when, and to use their toolkits and their experience to get the bank's balance sheet so positioned. These toolkits include derivatives, but they also include the investment portfolio, cash, FHLB advances, and other non-core funding financial instruments. Funds transfer pricing is part of the toolkit, which they use to steer the pricing of loans and deposits to align with their IRR policies and tolerances. used together, their ALM toolkit operates much like a pilot's yoke, which they can deploy to pull IRR back or push it forward, to rein it in or to let it ride, and to plan to avoid the air pockets and headwinds depending on what they see ahead through the windshield, which, like the area around Gravity Hill, can be deceiving and lead you to believe your balance sheet is becoming more asset sensitive when it is really reversing and becoming liability sensitive, fool you into believing your deposit beta is low and going to get lower when it is about to go to 100%. But that is what they get paid to do, to manage IRR, set limits, and watch the road ahead, even when they are in a cloud and cannot see much beyond the next quarter. Ultimately, what matters is that at the end of the day, they make their destination, their NII and NIM, on time and as projected, because those are their deliverables as far as their CFO is concerned. And the good news is that they will make those projections, but the bad news is, or the reality is, that there is no magic in the results that can be performed overnight. Because even if bank treasurers are neutral, they mean over time, not over the next second. If tomorrow the Fed were to cut the Fed funds rate by 300 basis points in one fell swoop, a change of that magnitude would cause some rocking somewhere on the boat, hopefully no worse than what Metro New Yorkers felt during the unusual earthquake back on April 5th. But give bank treasurers a quarter, 6 months, a year, or 2 years, they can adjust, restructure what needs to be restructured, and set up asset and liability cash flows to bring NII and NIM back in line with earnings projections. And while bank treasurers usually seem like magicians, mistakes in the unexpected can happen. Look at what happened last year to Silicon Valley Bank, which bank treasurers insist was a unicorn, that they would not have taken the risk taken there. But was it really such a unicorn? If other banks were so smart not to buy bonds when interest rates were at all-time lows, how come at year-end 2023, the negative fair value mark on the banking industry's total investment portfolio, including bonds and HTM and AFS, equaled 18% of tangible common equity adjusted for taxes? Some bank or banks must have bought MBS and other long-term bonds, bonds which, if they were sold today, would generate a realized loss of quite some magnitude and wipe out earnings. According to Q4 2023 call reports, only 374 commercial banks out of 4,585 held securities in HTM and AFS that had no fair value loss. Of course, there was a time when buying bonds seemed like a smart trade. Let's roll the tape back for a whole minute. Consider the following circumstances. The time is 5 years ago, April 2019. What would you have done? The FOMC had been on pause for two meetings, and the forwards were flashing that the Fed would cut rates before the end of the year, maybe one, maybe even two times. Bank deposits exceeded total loans by $3 trillion, a figure which today seems tame considering that deposits exceed loans by $5 trillion, but on an $18 trillion balance sheet back then, compared to the $24 trillion balance sheet which prevails today, it was a lot of money to have sitting around at the Fed earning 2.4%, which the Fed was about to lower to 2.35% when, say, MBS was yielding close to 4%. Playing it safe in cash 5 years ago was not exactly accretive to NIM. And lest you forget, your bank's NIM, assuming you match the FDIC industry average, peaked in Q4 2018 at 3.48%, and you had also booked record NII. But in the new year, the numbers for Q1 2019 were coming in lower, and Q2 2019's projections did not look any better, which certainly would not have made your CFO very happy. Your entire thought as bank treasurer was to protect NIM and NII, if not for your career, to shield the public from the ugly truth that as an asset-sensitive bank, you do less well when rates are falling than when they are rising. There was talk of recession, how it was overdue, and that recessions were inevitable, then like now. That meant probably credit losses were coming, which would have meant that your CFO would have been looking for Treasury to pump out more interest income from the bond portfolio to help cover the credit tab. Would have had the feeling of that pressure. And if you had any doubt about the way the winds were shifting and the picture changing, you could have looked to the inverted 2s-10s yield curve for confirmation that who knows what kind of a recession, probably mild, was coming, which meant so were rate cuts, maybe even more than the forwards were expecting. And you had to consider what was going to happen with your deposits, which if obviously we're not going to fund loan growth during a recession, it had to go somewhere. And in recessions, people spend less money, which means they will save more, which means you will have more cash to invest. Everything cannot stay at the Fed overnight, be risk-free. What do you do when the excess deposits pile starts to grow? That would not have helped NIM. The mounting pressure to keep NII and NIM on track was palpable in the conference room off to the side of the elevator in the Treasury Department, where bank treasurers huddled with their assistant treasurers, chief investment officers, funds managers, and ALM heads. Bank Treasury 101 says in such circumstances, you buy bonds, because that is what all good fixed income investors are supposed to do when the Fed starts to cut interest rates. That is the best time to buy bonds. The best time to not buy bonds is when the Fed is about to raise interest rates, as was the case 3 years later in 2022. But in April 2019, like today, the Fed was supposed to be done with rate hikes, and the next move expected by the forwards and everyone who was paid to project these things for the street would be a cut. Now, adding to the pressure, your balance sheet was becoming more asset sensitive, which increased your IRR if rates fell. This happened because your depositors sat on their cash, left more of it in non-maturity deposits than they had ever left in those accounts in modern banking history, earning just a couple of basis points. Meanwhile, more and more of your earning assets sat at the Fed or in short-term bonds earning a pittance. Today, the situation is totally different. The only people who still want to sit in cash are bank treasurers because even though they are not crazy about the strategy, they cannot ignore TINA. There is no alternative. But aside from them, other corporate treasurers are more careful about the cash they leave in checking, as are consumers who reportedly are still looking to lock up their cash in CDs, as the CFO from one of the global banks told analysts. Quote, migration from checking and savings to CDs is sort of the dominant trend that is driving the increase in weighted average rate paid in the consumer deposit franchise. That continues. There is a narrative out there about how we are seeing the end of what people sometimes refer to as cash sorting. We've looked at that data. We see some evidence that maybe it's slowing a little bit. We don't think it makes sense to assume that we are in a world where checking and savings is paying zero and the policy rate is above 5%, that you're not going to see ongoing migration, end quote. In April 2019, non-interest-bearing deposits equaled 24% of total deposits, well above the historical average. Today, the ratio stands at 22%. And so, if you were the bank treasurer back then, you had a choice. You could have stood by and watched your NIM narrow and your NII growth flatten, or you could have stopped being afraid, gone out, taken some interest rate risk, and tried to earn some money for shareholders. Many brave bank treasurers ventured out on the maturity spectrum, which at first went well, and looked prudent, especially as the Fed went on to cut rates 3 times in the second half of the year, all the way to 0% by March 2020. Speaking in the fall of April 2019, after the FOMC had already cut the target range twice by 25 basis points, once in July and again in September, just 1.5% to 1.75%, the senior officer of one of the Federal Home Loan Banks made the following observation in a strategy piece he wrote that was addressed to his FHLB members. Quote, in the post-crisis operating environment, many members have become asset sensitive with an expectation of rising rates while accepting substantial exposure to declining rates. In the recent declining rate environment, those asset sensitive members may be experiencing significant NII deterioration. Having a more neutral ALM position can assist with managing IRR and maximizing income across various interest rate environments, end quote. Bank treasurers could use FHLB advances to help manage this sensitivity, as the officer continued, quote, taking a bet on the direction of interest rates is admittedly risky and can expose you to greater risks, leading to lost earnings opportunities. Depending on the area of exposure, asset-sensitive members may want to consider shortening liabilities or adding long-term assets to become better match-funded, whereas liability-sensitive members may want to consider taking advantage of points on the inverted advance curve to add term funding at advantageous levels, end quote. Adding long-term assets was one of several strategies bank treasurers pursued that year to protect their NIMs and NIs, and later in 2020, when rates were back to the zero lower bound, and the subject of negative interest rates was being seriously debated among Fed economists, when deposits by then exceeded loans by over $7 trillion, and when non-interest-bearing deposits exceeded 30% of total deposits, making bank balance sheets even more asset-sensitive than they were back in April 2019. When all that was going on, buying bonds was not only defensible, it was downright prudent, even if in hindsight it turned out all wrong. But for the record, to be fair, it was not a great time to buy bonds then as now, for a lot of reasons, starting with the fundamental one, which is that term extension trades are upside down when the yield curve is inverted. In nominal terms, at least, the extension leaves the investor with a lower initial yield, which is only recouped if the Fed cuts rates enough to make the initial give up worth the investment. When the spread between 3-month and 5-year treasuries was 120 to 130 basis points last month, to extend required the Fed to cut rates aggressively for the extender to profit from this strategy. The investor would have had to believe that a harder than expected landing was coming to buy into it. Even this month, with the spread falling to 60 to 70 basis points, the give up seems too aggressive given the continued demonstrated strength of the U.S. economy. On top of that seemingly straightforward problem, they have had with the trade back in April 2019, fixed income investors would have incurred a negative term premium to extend duration. If, for example, you had invested in a zero coupon treasury bond for 5 years because you believed the Fed would be cutting rates and you wanted to protect the bank's NII when rates were lower by purchasing bonds when rates are higher, the market would have charged you a negative term premium for the extension, which ordinarily would be positive to compensate an investor for taking on extension risk. Going out further out the curve 5 more years would have cost the same. But 1 year later, when negative interest rates policy was in vogue, extending 5 more years to 10 years would have cost you an even higher negative term premium. As a buy-seller hold signal, the term premium can be confusing. In March 2022, investors were being paid to assume extension risk, which turned out to not be enough to compensate for the unrealized losses they would have assumed a year later. On the other hand, a positive term premium could have been interpreted as a sell signal, telling you that rates were likely to increase, not decrease. On the other hand, it might have been a buy or hold signal, paying investors instead of charging them to assume or hang on to extension risk. If it had been paying attention to term premia, SVB would most probably have interpreted it as a buy signal, which it would have discovered was false. Bank treasurers say they are considering extension trades again, inverted yield curve and term premium confusions aside, as the CFO from a global bank told analysts, quote, "We've started to do that to some degree in the first quarter to buy some securities, mainly mortgages, given where rates and levels have been. And that's been a good trade, I think, for us so far. I think you'll see us continue to deploy more cash into securities, at least at some modest level, as we look forward over the next quarter," end quote. The CFO from a large regional bank in the Northeast went into more detail on the bank's purchases of securities in Q1 2024, telling analysts, quote, "We are trying to keep our convexity flat, purchasing treasuries and CMBS, which basically has positive convexity coupled with some low convexity MBS. The yields have been around 4.6% with duration at about a little over 3 years. Today, the Fed is officially on the verge of cutting interest rates, though verge might be too aggressive a word considering the latest spate of economic data. But assuming the Fed is done raising rates for this cycle and ignoring the term structure fundamentals, bank treasurers could be forgiven for once again giving some consideration to an extension trade for their $5 trillion in excess deposits, even if they're not seriously worried about the Fed suddenly cutting rates by 300 basis points, it is very reasonable to assume that interest rates are headed lower, if not this year, then next year. Why? Because the Fed views a Fed funds target range holding at 5.25% to 5.5% to be restrictive, and therefore, at some point, it will ease until it is satisfied that interest rates are at a neutral level. The economy is going bang gangbusters, and for now at least, the present level of rates is not hurting it. Retail sales were awesome last month, but the Fed must cut regardless because a permanently restrictive monetary policy is not a monetary policy at all. And if nothing else, leaving rates at these levels leaves the Fed less room to raise rates for the next time. Presumably, if 0.25% is too accommodative and 5.25% to 5.5% is too restrictive, it is not unreasonable to believe that neutral is somewhere in the middle. But where exactly is neutral? The Fed believes it will know it when it sees it, but how do you find it to see it? Without a roadmap like the one to find Gravity Hill, members of the FOMC look to R-star, a hypothetical, cannot be directly observed, risk-free overnight interest rate, which is neither restrictive nor expansionary for an economy that is at full employment. R-star represents an equilibrium between supply and demand for money, which moves around over time, higher and lower. Some economists believe that it is higher today than it was in April 2019, while others believe that it is unchanged. But what if R-star is just an illusion? Maybe there is no equilibrium price for money that clears the market. A New York Fed economist wrote a paper published last month that makes this very point, that assuming that there is an equilibrium in systems leads to a lot of model error. How else to explain why, after holding the Fed funds rate for 9 months and counting at the highest level that has been in decades, the economy remains unbowed and inflation remains stubbornly above 2%? Doesn't lag effect mean anything these days? But what if the level of interest rates does not matter as much in 2024? And what if there is no equilibrium rate? Maybe R-star is just an illusion, a trick of the lights, maybe. Maybe cutting rates will not be any more inflationary than raising rates has proved to be disinflationary. One reason to be agnostic on the existence of R-star is that the capital markets are very different today than they were in the previous credit cycles. Today, unregulated shadow banks driven by private credit providers are expanding their participation in the capital markets at the expense of the banking industry. Bank treasurers complain about this all the time, about the unlevel playing field, and how the Basel III endgame and regulatory regimes like it are ruining it for banks to participate in the capital markets the way they were once able to do. Which sounds bad, but from a public policy perspective, perhaps not a bad outcome if we want to reduce the likelihood of a run on the financial system and we want to avoid credit crunches that could exacerbate a downturn in the economy. Banks are usually the first ones out the door at the smell of smoke. But in a backseat position, with the shadow banks and foreign banks owning all that leveraged debt with sketchy outlooks, as credit losses mount per the Fed's latest shared national credit exam, the run could end up being a nothing burger, despite all the hand-wringing about corporate bankruptcies and troubled office commercial real estate. The new players on the block may stick around longer and not run. Private debt providers, especially those that are unlevered, are going to be less concerned with the level of interest rates as long as they can earn a return for their investors, which makes the financial system far more stable than it was in previous economic cycles. The downside is that if the private credit providers pull back from the capital markets, from leveraged loans, commercial real estate, and consumer savings and credit, the blowback to the rest of the economy and indirectly the banking industry could be significant. The pullback may already be happening. As the chairman and CEO of a large asset manager observed, quote, "The large pension funds that have an overallocation of private equity and the rotation of money in the private equity area has slowed down precipitously. We are also seeing evidence that more and more clients are keeping a higher balance of cash to meet their liability discharges. And so, without the momentum and the velocity of money in private equity, they must keep higher cash balances too," end quote. But it is not just consumers, because businesses are sitting on more cash, even if they are being more selective about where they keep it, as the CFO of a global custodian bank told analysts this month, quote, "As the conditions in the economy continue to evolve, clients are holding more cash on their balance sheets," end quote. Thanks to the competition from shadow banks, high interest rates, and the general economic uncertainty, loans are growing slowly on bank balance sheets while deposits have stabilized and started to trend higher. As the CFO of a global custodian bank continued, quote, there does tend to be somewhat higher deposits in the banking system. So the tide has been gently rising, I'd say very gently. And loan growth has slowed, as the CFO from another global bank explained. What we're hearing from clients in the commercial bank or some of the clients in the corporate investment bank, they're being cautious still and saying, well, okay, I'm not going to build inventories as much as I might have in a different environment, end quote. This still leaves bank treasurers with $5 trillion in excess deposits to invest, of which $3.6 trillion is in a Fed Reserve account earning 5.4%. Asset sensitivity is increasing again, and it could be fair to conclude, as bank treasurers concluded 5 years ago, that they and the financial markets are swimming in liquidity. Except that liquidity is a mirage. Like neutral interest rate sensitivity and neutral interest rates, it does not exist, or at least it is fleeting and unreliable at best. 1 minute there is plenty of liquidity in the financial system, everything is fine, and then it all goes poof. On September 15, 2019, there was suddenly no liquidity in the repo markets. The Fed had to pump in reserves and buy T-bills for its SOMA portfolio, and even had to cut interest rates twice before the end of 2019 to restore market liquidity. And just a few months later, you had COVID and the lockdowns, and again, liquidity just dried up in a flash. Again, the Fed had to move heaven and earth with special facilities and another dose of quantitative easing in the trillions of dollars to right markets. And finally, there was the crisis in March 2023, which led to the creation of the Bank Term Funding Program. So to say that markets are liquid today still begs the question, where does all the liquidity go when it disappears? Because liquidity does not really exist in terms of hard cash. There is no hard cash, currency, stacks of $100 bills, or piles of coins to point to and say, here is the liquidity. Liquidity does not exist. It is just an accounting entry on the Fed's balance sheet that echoes on bank balance sheets and on the balance sheets of other financial participants in the capital markets. Thus, since last summer, as it continued to shrink SOMA by another $1 trillion, the Fed kept its reserve account flat and instead reduced the RRP from $1.3 trillion to $0.4 trillion. Shrinking the RRP meant that money market funds had to go back into bank deposits, which in higher rate times like these, banks are only too happy to take back with open arms. As the CFO from a global custodian bank explained, deposits are moving higher despite QT because, quote, we think that's a mix of central bank actions. In the U.S., the reduction in the overnight repo operations that the Fed's run, that comes back in a way to into our clients or into the banking system. And that's been, I think that's generally improved liquidity conditions and added to what is our very liquid conditions have made them even more liquid, end quote. But where is the money? Deposits are not sitting somewhere gathering dust in a bank vault. President Franklin Roosevelt explained this to the American people, who had huddled around their vintage Philips radios when he delivered one of his fireside chats in 1933. This was the same chat where he explained the reason why he had closed all the banks for a bank holiday, which was to prevent a wider run on the financial system. Quote, first of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, bonds, commercial paper, mortgages, and many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning around. A comparatively small part of the money you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is wholly sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a small fraction of the total deposits in the banks. End quote. When FDR spoke to the nation to explain how banks work, currency in circulation equaled $5 billion, and deposits for commercial and savings banks equaled $27 billion. Today, those numbers are $2.3 trillion and $18 trillion, respectively. Yet, currency in circulation remains roughly the same fraction of total deposits. If all the deposits in the system had to be monetized overnight, it would require the Fed's balance sheet to double in size to provide enough currency to meet the demand. Liquidity is not about hard cash. It is about trust. Your money is safe in the bank, like our currency, is a statement of faith, like believing God. Stop believing and you can have a run. The establishment of the FDIC helps with that faith, but FDIC insurance did not stop withdrawals of large uninsured deposits from Washington Mutual during the global financial crisis. Illusions of safety are easily shattered, which is why some of the public's trust needs to be placed with the Fed as lender of last resort, which is a sore subject for bank supervisors, still smarting over SVB going to its FHLB for a loan when it got into trouble, and that it was not even set up to use the discount window when it failed. One of the lessons bank supervisors believe they have learned from the crisis last year was that this needs to change, that bank treasurers need to have the Fed's discount window in their operational liquidity plans. To that end, bank examiners are guiding banks to establish pre-positioned collateral at the discount window to use in case of another liquidity crisis. Fed Governor Bowman this month summarized her concerns with this approach, speaking to a roundtable sponsored by the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation. Quote, "One prominent issue that has come to light recently is whether there should be some form of pre-positioning requirement, whether banking institutions should be required to hold collateral at the discount window in anticipation of the need for accessing discount window loans in the future," end quote. This could be a good idea, but, as she continued, quote, "to fulfill its functions, the discount window must be able to provide liquidity quickly. The failure of SVB demonstrated how rapidly a run can occur and revealed that the discount window must be able to operate in a world in which new technologies, rapid communications, and the growth of real-time payment may exacerbate the speed of a bank run," end quote. And no good idea comes without a price, because even if the discount window were open 24/7, requiring bank treasurers to pre-position collateral at the discount window could be detrimental to profits and interfere with efficient ALM. Indeed, bank treasurers are already concerned that pledging so much collateral at the window could reduce the amount of collateral available to borrow from the FHLBs. And Governor Bowman asked, quote, "Would requiring prepositioning of collateral impede a bank's ability to manage its day-to-day liquidity needs, including from private sources at lower cost? Would prepositioning collateral increase operational risk or otherwise change bank activities? Would there be any unintended consequences from requiring banks to encumber more assets on their balance sheets? More fundamentally, is a change of this magnitude, requiring a new daily management of discount window lending capacity, necessary and appropriate for all institutions, or are there particular bank characteristics that may warrant this additional layer of liquidity support?" End quote. Liquidity all comes down to trust, and to keep that trust from being shattered, FDR's banking reforms established deposit insurance and reaffirmed the Fed's role as lender of last resort. But in addition, bank regulation and supervision helped to anchor the public's trust in that the banking system is a safe place to put one's trust, even if their money is not technically there. Unfortunately, bank regulation and supervision are not one united front, because the U.S. banking system's oversight is shared among a host of federal and state agencies who put out their own regulations and communicate their own guidance to the institutions they have chartered. At the federal level, there is the Fed, the OCC, the FDIC, and at the state level, there are 50 individual state banking departments. State-chartered banks are supervised locally, but all banks are supervised at the federal level, with either the Fed, the OCC, or the FDIC serving as an institution's lead examiner. Credit unions are separately supervised through the National Credit Union Administration. Far from being a united front, this complicated web of bank supervisory agencies and departments compete with one another, for better or for worse, for bank charters. Banks are in fact known to shop regulators to find ones that will say yes, not no. Out-of-state bank mergers can add to one state banking department's roster at the expense of another. Why is the system the way it is? The real reason is that this is the way the banking system developed over 200 years, as a work in progress, patchwork system with the banks first regulated only at the state level. The OCC was not chartered until 1863. The Fed came in 1914 and the FDIC came in 1933. The system is known as the dual banking system, where banks could be regulated by more than one regulator, an answer to state and federal examiners. Alan Greenspan believed in the dual banking system and that banks should have the ability to choose their regulator. Otherwise, an overly strict bank supervisor might prevent innovations that a different set of eyes would have greenlighted. That could be good, but it could also be bad. A paper by the Richmond Fed suggested that it depends. The IMF thought it was bad, and there are other studies that think the same thing. Generally, the public sees a united front in umbrella bank supervisory associations, such as the Federal Financial Institutions Examinations Council, which includes the Fed, the OCC, the FDIC, the NCUA, and the CFPB, and the State Liaison Committee, the latter which includes representatives from the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, the American Council of State Savings Supervisors, and the National Association of State Credit Union Supervisors. Yet, sometimes the disunity among the various agencies is hard to hide from the public. The OCC's latest proposal on bank mergers is a case in point, which was notably not joined by the Fed and the other bank supervisors that make up the FFIC. If the rule is adopted, which would seem as drafted to raise the bar to get approval for a bank merger, there is a risk that the other regulators may make different rules. As a partner of Davis Polk observed this month, quote, "I worry about individual federal banking agencies putting out individual policy statements and expressing their own individual agency views on statutory standards instead of developing an interagency approach," end quote. Sometimes the dual banking system can get in the way of effective bank supervision. As the Fed found during its review of SVB, the supervisory system can be inefficient in communicating to banks when it is critical. Quote, "The memorandum of understanding was still in draft form and was in process of being submitted to the California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation for another round of review when SVB failed. The MOU drafting process involves stakeholders across all agencies, including the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, Board of Supervision and Regulation, Board Legal, and the CDFPI, and can be time-consuming to complete," end quote. Neutral balance sheets, neutral interest rates, liquidity, and the sense that the way bank regulation and supervision is set up in this country is capable of supervising banks in these times of flash liquidity crises that bring down investment-grade banks overnight or over weekends may all be an illusion. But some things are real. When you finish at Gravity Hill, go back to Bedford on SR220 and stop at the Route 220 Diner, where breakfast is served all day. The cook in the kitchen in the back room is said to be a wizard with Belgian waffles.